Good afternoon, everyone. I'm just going to wait another 2 minutes and then we're going to start so the people outside can come in. But if you want to get cookies or coffee, now's the time. And I believe we have a lot of cookies, so feel free to take them. We break the rules. No, we had it last time too. We weren't supposed to. Nobody yelled. I know, but... Okay, everyone, I'd like to begin the meeting. I believe all of you have picked up your documents as you came in. If anyone hasn't done so, could you please do so right now? So I would ask you to all take a look at the agenda. And I will begin by the approval of the agenda. Could I have someone move to approve the agenda, please? And state your name. Brian. And second? Thank you. We'll move on to item number 2, which is the approval of the minutes from June 12, 2014 and December 5th, 2014. I'm sure everyone has read them thoroughly, so I'm going to ask if anyone, first of all, has any corrections or clarifications on the minutes provided. If not, I will ask that we approve, first of all, the June 12, 2014 minutes. Could I have someone move to approve? Thank you. And moving on to the December 5th, 2014, can I have someone move to approve those minutes? Thank you. Moving on to item number 3. Yes. No. Item number 3, amendment to the Menaka Trust Fund. Now, I'll have our legal representative come up in a minute to discuss the merits of this, but basically, the trust fund that was created in 2009, the manner in which it's worded is such that we cannot touch the money at all, ever. So regardless of having close to $1 million in there, there's no way for us to ever access it. And I will have our lawyer to explain why that is and what we need to do to fix it. Thank you, Sibel. You didn't do it.
I did not set up the trust. Hi, my name is Sibel. I work at the law firm of Benoit Marceau Grenier Chartineau. Some of you may remember my partner, Georges Marceau, who used to come. Yes, he has retired since then. But I just wanted to explain to you guys that there was a trust set up in 2009 that has nearly $1 million in it. The beneficiary and the trustee is Munaka. But the way the trust was set up at the time is that the only thing that Munaka can actually take out of this account, it's a protected account, it becomes its own, what we call a patrimony, it's its own thing. And the only thing that can be taken out of this account is a certain amount per year, which is a very small amount, for tax purposes only. So basically that money has been sitting there and cannot be used in any way. Now, legally speaking, the trust has to be amended or modified with court approval, and it's a very complex process that doesn't really happen very often. It's the first time that I see a trust that no one can touch ever. So we have to find a way to amend it, and what our recommendation was for you to adopt a motion, first of all, because you are the beneficiary and the trustee, and, you know, MUNACA is basically the one that set it up and the one that benefits, so MUNACA can agree with itself, we think, to amend it. So we would ask you to amend it, and the wording of it, which is up here, can you open it for me? Okay, perfect. So basically, if you have the document, it's two paragraphs. What is changing is what's underlined. What used to be there is what is not underlined. And basically, we want to amend the purpose of the trust. Originally, what I think you need to know mainly is that the purpose of the trust was just to remain as such. And so what we are amending it with is to provide the beneficiary of the trust with any and all sums it deems necessary to carry out activities and or offer benefits for its members. And we also changed the distribution policy for this to be able to be carried out. Meaning, what we want is for you to be able to, as a union, access the money and then use it. Now, this does not discuss the purposes for which you will use it. My understanding is that that will be discussed in a subsequent General Assembly in September. So it will be decided by General Assembly as well. But we first have to do the procedures to open the trust legally so that you as a General Assembly then can vote what to do with the money. Because if you vote right now, it doesn't change anything because you can't access it. So basically that is the gist of the resolution. And then we have to go to court and see if this resolution is satisfactory. Unfortunately, this is not something that we've seen before in case law. So we can't guarantee what will happen. We tried to put the simplest wording to get the judge to approve it. So if the judge approves it, then you'll have a subsequent General Assembly and you'll discuss what to do with the money. If there's any issues, then it may come back too, but we don't anticipate that there will be any problems once this resolution is passed. I hope this is clear for everybody. Thank you.
So again, just to reiterate what happened and what we have to do to change it, the original trust is locked, so it's very nice that we have this money. There's no way we can touch it. So, again, you may recall that when we were elected back in 2009, I had assured you all that that money will remain yours, and I'm here to repeat that. That money will always be yours. You, the membership, will decide what will be done with it. So what we're trying to do right now is open it so that you would have that ability. And as Sibel pointed out, in the fall, we will hold a special General Assembly where you will decide what you want to do with this money. So it is not going to be the executive or the board that's going to decide what's going to be done with it. It will be the membership. We will, of course, bring recommendations because I'd love to give it all back to you, but legally, there are huge taxation issues over that. So the government would end up getting at least half of it. And I don't think any of us want that to happen. So we're going to try and find a way that it will still benefit the membership, but yet you would have access to it. And again, that will be brought to you in the fall, and you will decide. Between now and that time, we will hold information sessions to explain what can and cannot be done and what the possibilities are on your end. So if everyone has read through this, I would ask, first of all, are there any questions? Scott, and do we not have microphones? Could you please come to the microphone?
I just have a question. I don't remember when we made it up. What was the purpose of it initially? Do you remember?
Well, we didn't make it up. It was made up by the previous executive.
Okay.
And we found out about it during the strike because we wanted to access it to help both the membership and office to continue, and that's when we discovered we have no access to it.
So it was set up by the previous administration executive, but written up by some lawyer at that time.
Yes. Not
I think
this lawyer.
Sure.
No, I'm a labor lawyer. We didn't write it, but I can explain that the original intent seems to be that the money would be invested and gather interest and grow.
And grow. And it was a bit
into
of a full...
what? I don't know why. I don't know.
Yeah, there was no specifications as to what it was meant to do.
So it was a bit of a faux pas by whoever did the wording of it or wrote it up that we would not be able to access it.
Yes.
Without amending by general... Don't forget, it has to be amended. In order to amend it, MUNAC has to agree. It has to be by General Assembly. That seems to be the intent, that it would come back to the General Assembly.
Okay, so we put it into a safe place but threw away the key.
Yes.
Pretty much.
All right.
Are there any other questions? Could you please come to a microphone?
Has it actually grown? Have we received any interest from it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been reinvested because we can't take out more than a very small amount, as it was explained, but it definitely has grown. In fact, because of the amount there, there was a minimum return of 5% guaranteed.
Okay. Thanks.
So to be clear, this does not change the fact that it is still growing. This only changes the fact that you would now have access to it. And again, I reiterate, what you want to do with it will be up to you. So if there are no other questions, I would ask for a vote. All those in favor of amending the trust fund as presented here?
Somebody proposed it.
I proposed it. All those in favor? Against?
One against.
Carried. Thank you. So, moving on to item number 4, review of MUNACA financial assistance to members in need. Okay, this came about way back in 2011 during the strike. Which is common to have a hardship fund for those that could not survive on the strike pay alone. And since that time, some members have come to us to have other loans. Now, through the Board of Representatives, it was approved that these people would receive these loans. The issue that the executive have is, first of all, this is your money. We want to make sure that, A, you're okay with us lending money to people, because I could tell you not everyone has paid it back. And as so, we have outstanding $11,000 that is still owing. Now, some of that money is being paid back, but some have not at all. They have been taken to small claims court. And we are getting that money back because, again, this is your money. So what we're asking, or what I'm asking you today, is, first of all, do you want us to have such a fund or such access to the money that we would loan money out to individuals? That's the first question. And the second question is, you have to realize that some of that money will not be recovered. So if that's something that you guys are willing to do with your funds, then I'm willing to go along with it. But I can tell you that it is not an easy process, nor is it a pleasant process to get the money back from individuals. David, you have a microphone right there.
In any form of debate, I prefer to stand here with the other members rather than up there. That's my preference. So.
You guys not getting along?
Go ahead.
You're still a member down here, David.
Pardon me?
It's David.
Yes, I know. But I feel that debate should take place from the floor. That's what I think. I have risen in favor of continuing to lend money to members. I wish to just point out a couple of things. The, as far as I can recall, the members that refused to pay back any money and were taken to small claims court, they were given the money during the strike. And I think the bulk, and we're not going to stop offering hardship loans if we ever go on strike again. We have very, very few requests from members, and the criteria that are used are the same that were used during the strike as far as hardship. In other words, it's really a last resort for members. And I was in favor of taking those members to small claims court because they offered no explanation for why they were not paying. And I don't think that the rest of us should have to in any way pay for what I regard as deadbeats. I am a bleeding heart, and I will extend, you know, any help I can to anyone, but just basically telling the union to buzz off and the money, I'm entitled to it, or I was entitled, I don't really accept that. But since we did extend loans, since the strike, all of those members have, in one way or another, been able to pay back or are in the process of paying back their loans. So I don't find that it's not an ongoing issue. And I just think that if people really are in dire straits, they need to be able to go somewhere, and I just think the union is an appropriate body. I think we're in a position financially, and I think we have a duty to help our members if we can. We're not talking about extending loans of $10,000 to buy a car here. It's $2,000-$3,000 just to pay next month's rent and maybe a couple of outstanding debts just to kind of get through a tough period. So I hope people support that concept. I understand the reticence of some people, and it is the members' money. I think it was absolutely the right thing to take it to the General Assembly and ask people what they think. And obviously, I'll stand with any decision made. Thanks.
Again, I want to just point out that one of the reasons that it's being brought here is because obviously the general population did not know that this was a possibility. So I personally felt that you had to at least be aware that if you want to do this, that's fine, we'll do it, but the general membership should be aware that it's accessible. And that was not the case until today. Scott.
What percentage of the people have come to us? Like in the union, are we talking like 5%, 2%?
Well, again, Scott, the problem was nobody else knew about it. So certain people approached us, and therefore they knew that we would be able to do this. Mm-hmm. But again, if we're going to do it, like I said, that's the first question. If we're going to do it, then it has to be accessible to everyone. It can't just be accessible to those that come up and ask somebody from the board or somebody from the executive.
Right. Well, I agree with you, and I think that the union is an appropriate spot, as David said, to come, not another way to supplement your lifestyle, but to get you through those rough periods. I think that's part of why we're here. I have worked on some of the school boards where, say for the daycare or the lunch program, inevitably there are some people that just can't pay and don't pay. And as a community, I think that's part of our responsibility to say, okay, if they really can't pay, I think we should forgive that loan. And I think the time and effort that's put forward in small claims court maybe isn't worth the battle. I think it's hard for most of us to come to any group of people, especially our peers, and say, hey, I'm really in a hard spot. Could you give me some money? My kids are hungry. And for us to say, and this is where I disagree with David, I've agreed most of what he said, I don't call these people deadbeats. Okay? These are people that sometimes maybe just need a...
Can I just clarify something, Scott, please? we're talking... The union was prepared to be extremely flexible in terms of repayment. I mean, we would have accepted any amount back per month. And yes, I realize I'm making a moral judgment, and it's not on the whole person. I just, you know, I objected to that attitude. But we would have, you know, the board was prepared to accept, you know, $20 a month for even any effort whatsoever to pay that money back. And it was just the total refusal that I found, yeah, it was indicative of a deadbeat. If those people had even indicated they were still in extreme hardship, then I, for one, would be prepared to forgive it entirely. But that was not the case because they were asked repeatedly. So, just to qualify that.
I get that.
Before you go on, I just want David Collant to have a chance to say something.
Just your question before about how many people, I guess, after the strike, is less than 1%.
So less
but again, be aware that most people don't know about it. So
right.
Take that with a grain of salt. But I also want to reiterate what David said. It took a major discussion before deciding to go to small claims court. And not only did they not attempt to pay it back, they didn't even communicate. They wouldn't even bother communicating with us.
I get that, and that's wrong. And as a fellow bleeding heart, David, I understand where you're coming from. However, I think we have to be careful of that moral judgment. And I think it's great that if we find ourselves in a position where we can help out some fellow members, give them a leg up, I think we should. We're looking at $1 million, or we're going to be wondering what to do with come the fall. I'm thinking that may be a good spot. If we got some member that's got a $1,500 outstanding and they still can't make ends meet, I'm willing to say, okay, I'm helping to fund that, if it's legitimate. Not the deadbeat that you're speaking of, but if it's legitimate, I feel comfortable with that.
And that's exactly the question at hand. Do I have any other questions?
Hi, my name is Pina Giobi. I was one of those people that didn't know about it, but it doesn't matter. It's kind of scary, though, if you're opening it up to everybody and there could be abuse because we're not a bank. You guys don't do a credit check, and the money's there, you know, not to lend out money to people in need. We all have access to a credit line. I, during the strike, once I did my picketing, actually found another job to do on the side, and I earned money. Not everybody is as fortunate, I guess, but we can't just expect the membership to, like, for that money to disappear and just be used. I mean, like, some people might take advantage and have no intention of paying it back. We all have to be, you know, accountable for our expenses. Yes, people have to put food on the table, but are we all, how many times are we going to strike? You know what I mean? I think that was probably the one and only strike that we're gonna have. So I just don't want to see anybody taking advantage of the situation. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or statements? Yes. Sorry, there are no microphones up there. You guys have to sit closer.
Hi, I'm Mary Chin. For those who don't know me, I've been following this discussion in various stewards' meetings in the council. And I just came in from into the meeting, so apologies if I missed part of the discussion and this was asked. If we're going to open it up to the whole membership, I would suggest that we get an application process so that it's transparent and that people who want to ask for money understand the criteria and the information they need to provide and give some indication of their financial situation. I'm not saying that we should become a bank, but we do need a transparent process so that everyone understands from the beginning that this the conditions of the loan and that they're expected to repay within maybe a certain time period. Do we have that?
Yes, we do.
Okay, then I've
everything you asked for is in place.
Already. All right. So
they have to provide copies of bills, of various receipts, and what their monthly payments are for various things. They have to sign a document saying when they will start paying it back and how much per month,
Et cetera.
Everything you said is in place.
Okay, so also as chair of communications, I think it would be a good idea to put it on the website as a service that could be requested with maybe an outline of the process and sample forms if we really want to be more transparent and about the whole process.
The thing is, we're not opening a service to the membership. We're simply informing the membership that if they're in deep shit, this may be available to them. I mean, we're talking about people who fell on long-term disability, where you do receive less money. They were just caught in a very, very bad situation. There are members, they have jobs, or, you know, if they're on LTD, they have access to LTD, but it's not like, no one is proposing that we say, hey, we're going to be, we're going to create a credit union, we're going to now offer a loan. No, this is just to people who have literally nowhere else to go. I mean, there's people who tell us they have no family members, they don't have any credit to speak of. I mean, we don't expect them to max out their credit cards. This is an alternative to, you know, maxing out a credit card and then having to declare bankruptcy. And that's the sort of scenario we're talking about. But it's what Kevin was rightly referring to is just simply saying, by the way, it's not just reserved for people who happen to talk to a rep and say, I'm in big trouble. It's just everyone knows. That's part of the transparency. Yeah, if anyone, any one of our members finds themselves in a situation where there is basically no exit, this is a possibility, and that's exactly the type of scenario that we've seen in the last 3 years since the strike. That's the type of member that's come to us. It's like one or two a year. Okay. So.
Yeah, I agree. And as I said, I'm glad to hear this because I obviously missed some of the discussion. I'm thinking, certainly on the Muse website, they mentioned that they would make donations for. When I talk about putting it on our website, maybe just a page with one paragraph saying, this is a possibility. If you want more information, contact the steward or contact the Minoka office. And that would, I think, be transparent enough without going into great detail. It's, again, it's, I think it's up to the membership to decide.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
David.
Yeah, just a comment on the previous commenter. Not everybody does have access to credit elsewhere. Depending on their financial situation.
Sorry, Scott, it was somebody before you.
And also further to what David says, they do have to give evidence, very clear evidence, of what they have tried to do to alleviate their situation before they come to us.
Could we just not do it, like, during a strike, then this is offered to them instead of, like, a full-time kind of idea? You know what I mean? Like,
well, it was offered during the strike as
right.
a hardship fund, and
right.
that is the norm
right.
because that's when people definitely do need assistance.
Yeah.
It has expanded beyond that point. And as I said, because it is sort of a closed system, nobody else knows about it, only certain people have accessed it, which I agree is not a huge number of people. But if we are going to do this, if we're going to have a fund for assisting individuals, then it needs to be everybody or nobody.
For
so
sure.
That's why it's being presented to you
yeah.
that if this is something that you agree with and that we should continue doing,
yeah.
that's fine. We will, but it will be open to everyone because I don't know, there could be people that nobody's heard of that are sitting in their offices and they are in financial problems and they have nowhere to turn and we don't know about it. So
yeah.
if we don't tell them that we're doing this and that it's a possibility, then we have to make sure that everybody has access to it.
Of course.
If they need it.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is it should only be used in the event of a strike, you know, not indefinitely, whatever the situation is, because that's just a bit much. But that's all. Just in a huge event that affects everybody, as in a strike, then that benefit is offered to them, you know, not all the time. That's all I'm saying. It's just a suggestion.
Okay.
Can I ask why you believe that, since we pointed out the members who did receive money since the strike actually are the ones who have been paying back?
No, that's a good point. I was just curious
to know why.
I don't know, because that's what I would find then when the need would be the most applicable.
These are due to unexpected events usually, so.
Yeah, but I would find the strike would affect most people most of the time.
Yeah,
that's
right.
When it would come into play the most, you know. I don't have any credit. I have a hard time paying my bills. I deal with it. That's all I'm saying. But at a strike event, then I would maybe need some help, for sure. But that's the only time I could see that happening. Just, that's all.
Okay, thank you. Scott?
Well, lucky you, if it's only the strike that you'd find yourself in that situation.
There's other people out there that would find themselves in that situation, other times outside of the strike. I get letters in the mail from the union, Brother Scott, Sister Paula. Now, if we're one big family for brothers and sisters, this is how we take care of each other, be it the strike or outside the strike. You find yourself in dire need for whatever reason. You could have, there's a multitude of reasons where you could find yourself, a sick child possibly, or you could find yourself in a situation where you can't make ends meet through no fault of your own and nowhere to turn. Is not the union the place that should be, hey, we can give you a helping hand here, especially a union that has $1 million in the fund that we're wondering what to do with it. We're here to help each other out. We keep saying that the university is this and the university is that. We're different than them. We help each other out. During the strike, there's a lot of negative stuff that came out of it, but there was a lot of positive stuff. At least at MAC, at our group, it was fantastic. We had a great group, and we did just that. We had a little fund where people had donated money, and we went around and we nominated people that we knew were having a hard time. And we discreetly just slipped them some money or some certificates for a grocery store. And these are proud people. These aren't people trying to abuse the system, but we were there just to try to give them a leg up, and I think that's the least a union could do. We're brothers and sisters. Let's really act like we're brothers and sisters.
Thank you, Scott. Are there any other questions?
Hi, it's my name's Nancy. I do a lot of things in the union for my union. It's our union, and everyone in it are brothers and sisters. Like, I really shouldn't follow Scott because he's so eloquent. But I just wanted to say something here, is that this money isn't, sometimes we don't know when hardship hits, and this is what we're talking about here. I am a responsible human being. I work hard. I try not to get into debt, et cetera, but life happens sometimes. And I just want to go back to the strike, because that's what we seem to be focusing on. And we saw such goodness and caring for each other. I'll never forget the time that it was getting cold, and one of the members on the line left the line, took her snow pants off and gave them to someone else who was cold. We all felt good about that, and it made our day. So now we find ourselves back at work, and as a member of the grievance committee, as a member of someone that's really doing a lot of work for her union, I see need again, you know, and I see that I've actually helped process a couple of loans. I've had that privilege, and these are not people that would ask if they didn't need to, and they are paying back, right? And when we're talking about the people, if we have to talk about the few that didn't pay back, we're talking $2,000. Just so we have a number out there, $2,000. That's not a huge amount, you know. I'm not saying that it shouldn't have been paid. I'm not making a judgment. We're talking $2,000. Come on. And I just hope that we can decide here to set something up that can actually help people, because it's really, really important. This is what unions do. We help each other, and not just on a strike line, right? During our day-to-day when shit happens, and it does. Thanks.
Thank you, Nancy. Mary.
Hello. I'd like to suggest that if we do vote to continue this, perhaps we set a line item in the budget and like set a certain amount, so that it, at least that might answer some of the fears that there's too much money going out. Maybe we should decide on an amount or a percentage of the budget that would be set aside for hardship loans.
Thank you. There was another question?
Hi, Tim. I'm just curious to know, does PSAC actually offer something similar to this?
No.
No, the National Capital Region, the region, which we're not part of, we're part of the Quebec region, actually offers loans, but the Quebec region has never set something like that up.
Jane?
Various locals from unions across the country do this kind of thing, though. It's quite a normal thing for unions to do. It's not an unusual thing if you have money.
Yeah, and again, yes, that's exactly what's going to happen. You're going to have to vote on it, because as I said at the beginning, the board had decided to do this and it was supported, but it's your money. And yes, maybe we're missing $3,500 from people that have refused to pay anything back. It's not my money to say that's okay and you can keep it. It's your money. And again, I want you to realize that when they do not pay it back, we have to do something. Unless you want us to just drop it. But for me, as the representative who has to watch your money, because it's not my money, I have to do these things. And they're not pleasant. But these are the consequences. These people sign agreements that they will return the money. And then if they don't, we have to do something. So I just wanted to be clear that the reason it's brought here is so that we are doing it, we have been doing it, but if we're doing that, it shouldn't be for a select few. It should be for anyone in the membership who needs it. And yes, we're not just handing it out to anyone who comes and asks. There is a strict criteria. You do have to prove that you have made every effort to get the proper financial aid. And if you still cannot make ends meet, then we will loan you money. But again, this is something that has been done on the side. Today, we're opening it up because it's not fair that only some people know about this, and we don't know about the other people that are throughout campus that may be in need. So if this is something we're going to do, it has to be something that's available to everyone. So on that, I would propose that we vote on MUNACA opening a MUNACA financial assistance program that will have a strict guideline and that these monies will be loaned out under conditions that they be repaid. Do I have anyone that would second that? Thank you. David, wait.
No, I'm sorry. I'm just resting my hand here.
Yeah. So, on that, I would ask that all those that are in favor of creating such a fund, please raise your hands. One hand, please. Those against? The in favor have one, so we will be creating a fund. Now, this fund will be transparent. We will put up all of the guidelines. Everything will be set up, and it will be put up on the website because everybody should be aware of it. And the stewards and the representatives will also have access to the information. So if anyone is in need, they could approach any of the stewards or representatives, and that will come back to the VP Finance and the Board of Representatives. Thank you. Yes, you had a question. Otherwise, we can't record you, and some of us can't hear you.
Kevin, who seconded the motion?
Oh, well, many people. So
Scott was recording. Yeah.
Okay, Scott had his hand up first.
Just out of curiosity, if this is a decision is being made when we don't have kind of the full MUNACA assembly, I mean, we have a few people, but also I'm curious, well, personally, I'm not in agreement with it, so for those people who do not agree with this, if it's all our collective money, then I don't really like the idea that my money is being used for this. So what kind of recourse do those people who do not agree with this have?
Well, again, we have a general assembly to discuss this. We have the process to disseminate the information, to decide, and that's what this group is meant to do. So you have to come here and make that decision. And that's what we've done.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We will move on now to item number 5, which is the MUNACA Amuse merger update. Okay, as you know, over the course of the last year, Both MENAC and AMUSE have had votes, and those votes were held in our assemblies and their assemblies, and in both cases it was pretty much unanimous that we do want to merge. So with that green light, we've moved ahead to create a larger and stronger unit. Since then, we've been meeting with the AMUSE executive. We've been working on combining our structure and rewriting our bylaws. And to that effect, we were awarded a grant from the FTQ, which enabled us to hire an intern during the summer. This is a past law student here at McGill, and he's been working on our bylaws to see how they can be integrated and what needs to be changed and what needs to be removed. And that is an ongoing process. So the structure and the bylaws will be presented once they're finalized at the fall. There will be a fall special general assembly, and that's where we will vote on the merger in full, meaning the structure and the bylaws that govern it. So again, there will be time in between, for instance, the board and the executives on both existing units will have to review these bylaws and ensure that we are in agreement with them. Are there any questions? Great. So we will... Sorry, there is?
Yes, I would like to know, in addition to the discussions and the work on the bylaws and the structure that was in the Better Together document, is there also are there also discussions between the executives about a long-term plan for educating our membership, both memberships, about how we can have workplace solidarity going forward? And when I say workplace solidarity, what I'm talking about is that we foment a relationship between ourselves and AMUSE workers, where we understand that our basic needs and interests are the same on the job. So my question is, like, how many people here were casuals when you started at McGill? Okay. My next question is, how many of you encountered these attitudes, like you aren't serious about your work as full-timers, or like you were threats to full-timers because you were taking their work? Did anyone encounter that? Okay. That's what casuals encounter, whether it's spoken or unspoken, in my experience working in this union. I started as a casual in a McLennan shelving, and then became a full-timer, thankfully, because they were violating the labor code. By keeping me as a casual for well past the date, and I was received help from AMUSE. AMUSE is on top of it. They always have been since I started with them in 2011. So I would just encourage everyone here to think about that as a long-term issue, because really, in the grand scheme of things, now that we have this political merger, it's not just simply about they have numbers and we're going to have more resources and all this stuff. It's a day-to-day struggle to undo some of the socialization that I've experienced when management and administration use casuals to make us feel threatened. As an example, where I work, there were four casuals that were hired, and I'm telling you, a lot of people were like, hey, why are they hiring all these people? And I was like, this is great. We need them, and we need to, this might be their first taste of what it's like to be in a union. And I would just encourage everyone here to think about that kind of education initiative and ask the executive to have that for everybody, because it's good that we put all issues out on the table and not just think about structures and budgets and resources and things like that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Scott. Microphone, please.
Initially, you were saying you're going to go and monitor their negotiations, you or some representative from the executive. Has that happened?
No, because we haven't merged yet. So officially, we cannot actively partake in their negotiations, nor can they in ours. But we do communicate, and they do let us know what's going on. And as it would happen to be, that in both cases, the negotiator, I believe, is the same person, and so we have access to what's going on in both cases.
Okay, so you're not actually there as an observer?
No, we are not presently. But that is, as you recall from the Better Together documents, that yes, that is our intent. As we're negotiating, they would have somebody that would observe how our negotiations are going and what the topics are and how things are being either given or taken. And we would have the same on their end, because what the university loves to do during negotiation is they will negotiate with one group, it's usually us, and once they've finished with us, they apply whatever they gave to us, mm-hmm. or less, to everybody else.
Right.
And they don't go beyond that.
Right.
So in this case, we would know what's coming on both ends.
Okay. But that can only happen once we actually do
merge.
That's
correct.
Okay.
Is there anyone else? Great. Thank you. Moving on to executive reports. I will start with the grievance report. I believe you all have copies. So I will turn the meeting over to David Roseman, Vice President, Labor Relations. David.
Hi, I'm not going to read through this report, which was provided to everyone in writing. It would be, I think, quite tedious. There's such a broad range of stuff and such a mix when it comes to grievances, labor relations in general, it's hard to know where to focus. If you just look at the list, you'll see that there is a wide range of grievances. I would say that I want to just highlight the fact that the biggest change that's occurred in the last year that we've found is just the union is more present in the workplace. Some of it's not a dramatic change overnight, but there's just a slow increase in the presence of the union, meaning the stewards are more active, management is just more aware, oh, that's the union, we have to pay attention to them. And that has an impact on the day-to-day find. Of course, I'm not saying that it's very far from perfect. We're talking about incremental change here. There are areas like the Faculty of Arts reorg that occurred this past year. Basically, administration ignored the union for all intents and purposes, although they were cautious, I think, in how they did it for the most part, because the big difference I find with 5 years ago is that most managers on campus know that we're there and that we're serious and we don't just give up. So if they really want to take us on, 3 years later, it's still going to be an issue. And I would encourage the membership to just use the collective agreement. I'm not saying that we go around, you know, carrying the collective agreement and pointing to it, and you know, but it is a legally binding contract. The university knows it is. Sometimes they act as though it is not, but it is. And members sometimes are a little astonished when I just suggest, well, use the collective agreement. Use what's in there. The grievance process begins just with a meeting. It does not begin with any legal procedure. It allows you to have two union reps with you when you meet with management. Anytime management wants to meet with you just on an issue that you feel is a little sensitive, you have a right to ask for a union rep. I'm not talking about, you know, procedures inside the office like your or the workplace. You know, we're going to be installing a new piece of equipment. Here are the procedures. I'm talking about meetings to do with your working conditions. And it could be really on almost any subject. So there has been an increase in the past year. I don't know if there's been an increase in the actual events, but in our awareness of harassment of various sorts. What's termed psychological harassment is in the Minimum Standards Act, and there's a whole legal definition around it. We've been hearing it from all of, most of the time grievances haven't been filed, but we've been told of incidents that definitely involve harassment, so that's of great concern, and so I wanted to just highlight that. So if you hear of anybody going through anything like that, the union can help. We have a lot of experienced stewards now that are know how to deal with those situations. And sometimes we're successful in stopping things right at the outset. That's the key thing. Don't wait hoping things will get better. They almost never get better. At least we raise the issues, and with or without the union's help, if you raise them, there's a really good chance that they will get, management will back off, you know, because they don't always realize, oh, this is serious. That's pretty much, I didn't want to go through this written report in detail. There's a lot of, does anybody have any questions to do with grievances or any related subjects? No? Oh, yeah, okay.
My question is, have you settled some grievances this year?
Yes, we've settled about 10 or 12 just through initial discussions with management. Sometimes management really does want to settle grievances. We've had some grievances that were filed, for instance, just as Tim was alluding to, because there were casuals working in a job that shouldn't be casuals, and we've settled those out of court. We have a lot of the cases have been settled as well. They were in arbitration, but both parties indicated a willingness to settle those. No, most grievances are either settled or either during initial discussions or at the moment when we go to arbitration, because as I said, it's the collective agreement is a legally binding contract, and when push comes to shove, the university doesn't particularly want to go through and actually get a judgment from the arbitrator, from the court.
And my sub-question is, because of settling those grievances, are there changes coming to our new collective agreement or negotiations because of, let's say, gray areas or?
Well, there are some ambiguities that we've addressed at the negotiation committee. To be honest, we don't usually find that there's a lack of clarity. You know, but the university says there is.
Okay.
Recently they've told us that endowment funds should be considered like research funds because they're soft funds, and we said that's completely absurd, and nothing in the collective agreement even would suggest such a thing. So they just, you know, we had one case where they told our members that if you were on a progressive return off of sick leave, you couldn't take vacation. And we said, again, that's absurd. And we went into arbitration, and the arbitrator agreed with us, said, yes, that's absurd. So what I can't, you know, answer for the university, I don't know why they take some of the positions they do. But we have to be confident, you know, in our understanding. And I guess the point I'm just making is every time you think, aha, we'll add this word or we'll add this phrase to the collective agreement, that'll make it clear. But the next year, the university comes back and says, no, it's still not clear. Or we have a different understanding of it than you do. So there's an extent to which you can't resolve everything by changing the language or clarifying the language. But obviously, yeah, there are some parts. We've gone through it, and we will be proposing changes because we do think it could be clarified or strengthened.
Thank you.
So you were saying that 10 or 12 were settled out, and some of those were jobs where they were casuals and they shouldn't be casuals. Whereas as a result of that, those casuals became UNACA members?
That's correct.
Okay. So there were no results where casuals lost their jobs?
There were...
And did not become UNACA members?
There were two cases in which that occurred, and my understanding is that those members who are members of AMUSE left their work. One of them went back to school full time, and the other found herself another job. Those actually were not a result of, there were no grievances filed on that. There were two Article 39s, and yeah. And they were part-time workers, and those are the two exceptions I can think of. But in the cases where people were full-time and had been working a year or more in the same job, they were incorporated into Monaca and their seniority granted. Yeah, I mean, they never should have been hired as a casual in the first place. That was the union's point. It was the university trying. Part of the problem we're having is that there's a so-called hiring freeze. So the but the units still need people to work. So they find one way or another to hire. I was in court this morning with the SEIU. They contracted out handymen jobs in the residence as well. We're expecting those people to be recognized as McGill employees because they actually are McGill. But that was just the residents, as though they're told they can't hire anyone, so they find an indirect way. You're told you can't post a job, you hire a casual to do the job. This is the kind of thing going on.
Okay. Just to emphasize, like, that kind of issue going forward where there's an Article 39 and a MEWS member loses their job and is not incorporated into Monaca unit, my hope is that doesn't happen at all. It's down to zero, if at all possible, because when we have a political merger, ostensibly we're working together in the best interest of both units. So I hope that's the case going forward.
Yeah, so do I.
Thank you.
So I gather there are no other questions or remarks on this subject? Okay, thanks.
Thank you, David. Continuing with the executive report, I'd like to point out that, first of all, negotiations. We have set up our negotiation committee, which I believe most of them are here, and I would ask them if you're present, if you could stand up. Just so you guys know who is representing you. And I would just ask, no, don't sit down, Badawi. If you could just state your name and what group you are representing. Badawi?
My name is Badawi Shah, and I am part of the key council. Presently, so I'm one of the two keys on the negotiation committee.
Thank you, Badawi.
Move up. I'm representing the back campus.
Thank you. Deborah? Thank you. Jesse? Sherry? So just so it's clear, these are the people that you can submit your questions to. If you have concerns, if you have ideas, you can send it to them. You can, of course, send it to the executive as well, but just so you know, one-on-one, if you'd like, you have people that are directly representing your interests as C's, T's, and L's, and MAC. Now, moving on with that, as you may have noticed, the university recently put out a memo that said that they wanted to start negotiations. Now, this is unusual. That's never happened in the history of Monaca that we've actually started before. So we were kind of excited about that. So we were prepared to start. The first date was next week. They canceled. I got the cancellation this morning. So we will be starting tentatively in July. Again, I say tentatively because they've set dates, but we don't know how that's going to pan out. So going through the process, what we've done is we have set up the committee. We sent out a survey, and we had a good response to that survey. I believe it was about 600 or so members. Based on what we got from feedback from the membership, we were able to put together our list of proposals. I will briefly outline the proposals. I am not going to present them, and the reason for that is we have to present these to the university, and if they show up here, I guarantee you they show up in their lap. So I know it may not be the happiest thing for you guys, but you have to trust that what we're doing is in your best interest. And once we do present our list of demands to the university and they will give us theirs, we will post them on the website so everybody will see what is being asked. So I just want to make sure that that's why we cannot go into details at this point, what every point is, but I will give you a brief outline. So, one of the things that we're looking at changing is to strengthen the discrimination and sexual harassment. We want to add psychological because I think that's becoming more and more of a problem in this university. So we want to ensure that there's something in the collective agreement that adheres to the law that outlines what psychological harassment is. We're also looking at your 10th summer Friday that they stick at Christmas. We want to move that. The university effectively closes on that date, so therefore we lose it. So we are going to ask to have that moved. The other items will be the work premiums. Those will be going up. At least that's what we're attempting to do. And for weekends, we want it to be based on percentage. So in line with what the trades are getting, it would be something like 25% and then 50%. This is not a huge hardship for the university because there are not that many people that are doing it, but for the few that do have to do it, they should be paid accordingly for it. We're also looking at more flexibility in your vacation. As you know, you're limited to 10 days, the 10 single days that you can take. So we're looking at increasing that. We're also looking at moving some, for instance, for sick days, to have to the ability to take half a sick day, because sometimes if you go home in the afternoon, they could count it as a full day, and you lose a whole sick day, and we don't think that that's fair. They could do it. They don't generally do it because it doesn't make any sense, but they could do it. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. When it comes to monetary, that's probably going to be the hardest one, but we are looking at having fewer steps. Right now we're down to 12. We'd like to see that go down. So we're looking at moving that further down. We're looking at moving the minimum up so that there isn't such a huge spread between the minimum and the maximum. The biggest problem we're going to have is because of pay equity, and I will get to pay equity for those of you who are here for that subject. Because of pay equity, it caused a lot of inequity between the male-dominated and female-dominated. And it's very complicated, and I won't go into too much detail, but I'll just give you, in a nutshell, for a level 11 position, we now have approximately 4 to 5 different pay scales just for level 11 because pay equity PEDs that were affected by pay equity happen to fall under level 11. So we're proposing to bring that down to 1 because we can't have all of these different pay scales for the levels. But that's going to be a very complicated fight with the university. But I can say that that is what we did back in 2001 when the first pay equity exercise went in. We had to do that to be in conformity with the program that they use to analyze our jobs. So, with that being said, I will move on to pay equity. Okay. As you know, pay equity has pretty much been paid out for the 2001 to 2005 period. We're now looking at the 2010 maintenance that's coming up, we hope, this year. That's what the university has said. As you know, there have been numerous errors made, and we have been addressing those. And most of them have been corrected, but the latest one is they are trying to claim monies back from individuals that they paid last year, and they want to get that money back now. Now, we have been in talks with them, and I could tell you they wouldn't tell us who it was and why it was until recently. So recently we've had the information, we've gone through it, and I will defer to legal representation on the subject as to why they're out of delays. But that being said, some of the individuals that are being asked to pay back we have analyzed a number of them, and it does seem legitimate, but that's besides the point at this point, because they had plenty of time to correct this and they hadn't done it, so legally they cannot be claiming it back at this point. And again, I'll let the lawyer say legally, not necessarily just me. But some of the errors occurred because individuals called them and told them, you have me in the wrong PED. So they fixed it. And now those individuals have to pay the money back. So it's what I caution everyone to do is when you have any issues, especially when it's your salary, contact the union first so we can look at what the problem is and what is most advantageous to you. Because for some of those individuals, if they didn't say anything, it would never have happened. So just to keep it informed that you guys really need to talk to us before you send anything to HR. So, yeah, Sabelle, if you would just like to outline. And then anyone who does have any questions about pay equity, by all means. Go ahead.
Hi again. So this file has been led by my partner, Joanne Drelet, who's on leave at the moment. So I did take over quite last minute from her. Our understanding is that there are amounts being claimed from employees for overpayment. While we do not admit in any way, shape, or form, and neither should you, that there was overpayment, the number one thing that we're raising is that McGill had a certain amount of time from the moment they realized the overpayment to claim it back from you. We are stating that this is 6 months because you're unionized and the employer would usually have to grieve to get the money back in a way, and the claim that they can make is maximum for 6 months. So we are of the view that if they didn't claim it within the 6 months, then they're prescribed. That's the word used in the civil code and in the labor code, so that means they're too late. It's a fancy way of saying that, from claiming the money. I have drafted a response, a template that I believe your union has available for you and has forwarded to people and that you can get. But again, I cannot stress enough, the minute you get any kind of claim, verbally or in writing, speak with your union before you say yes or no. If you admit it and say you owe it or start to pay it back, then you could lose the benefit of the prescription. Now, this is the view that we've expressed to the union, that there's prescription. This has not gone to court yet. It might be different once it goes to court. That's our view. But a judge might rule differently. We don't think so, but it's always a possibility. Keep it in mind. But if you decide, well, I'm not too sure, I'll start to pay, then you'll lose the benefit of the prescription either way. So that's why our advice is to say they are prescribed from it, even if there was overpayment, not that we're admitting it, right? Because if they're not prescribed, then maybe we'll have a debate on how much the overpayment is. Was there overpayment? But we don't want to go there because we think they're too late. Quite simply. So that's our point of view, and your union has the template for those who may not have received it to be able to give that answer. And after that, well, it's up to you. You know, if there's people who feel like they want to pay, they can pay. Well, you know, if they decide to, again, you know, there's other issues, but if they decide to cut people's pay to get the money back, then I understand that the union will grieve this and will say that they were prescribed and should not have done that, you know. But we'll cross that when we get there. If some of you are having these kind of threats or these kind of issues, go see your union immediately. Do not try to settle this on your own unless you want to. Thanks.
She's not going anywhere.
I'm still here. Okay. Sorry. I just want to know, is the university bound to give us a calculation of how they came about giving us the amounts we received last year?
Well, bound. You can definitely ask for it, and I think that they should have to give it to
you. They have never supplied us. I've asked at least 3 times for a detailed calculation on how they came up with that amount.
The whole pay equity?
Well,
they're not bound to give a calculation of the details for the whole pay equity.
No,
I do think that they should explain the overpayment.
How they came to that amount that they gave me last August, and now they're reclaiming. How can they reclaim something that they paid to me, and I don't even know how they came to the first amount that I received initially?
Here's what I'll say. If they do sue people to get the money back, then they'll have to. It's their burden to prove this is how we calculated, this is what the overpayment is. So they might not have to give it to you right away because there's no lawsuit in place, but if they do sue you, they can't just show up in front of a court and be like, she owes me that. It'll be their burden to prove that they overpaid you. So they'll have to show everything. This is how we calculated. This is why there's overpayment. And this is when we found out, right, for the delay.
Well, there's also the fact that they had to supply us with the T-1198 for our federal taxes. Mm-hmm. To split it out over the years, and they put amounts on the year that I wasn't even an employee here. And so I brought it to their attention because I had to file my taxes, so I didn't bring it to your attention, but maybe that's
I do have to say, I think we have some accountants in the house. Those kind of elements I will defer as a labor lawyer.
Are there any other pay equity questions? So, just again to outline for the future, pay equity, first of all, never ends. So the 2010 maintenance will have to be done this year, and that will be subject to interest. So they will have to go back to 2010 and again readjust for anyone that was affected. Then they have to do 2015. We're hopeful that they'll do it this year, but there's no guarantee of that. But I could tell you that for the 2015, from our analysis, they will not have to pay out all that much. The next big sum will be for 2010. So we're hopeful that they will get on that. They claim that they will have that done by the end of this year. But again, we don't know how capable they are of getting everything done properly, because we would prefer now that they've learned some of the lessons from the last process and that they will communicate and work openly with us to ensure that everything is done properly. So you do have the executive report. I mean, I'm not going to read through the rest, but I'm just going to highlight a few other things. Just a side note that we did attend the PSAC National Triannual Conference that was held in Quebec City. This was in May. It was very interesting because finally we were there as delegates, so we could actually vote and partake in discussion. And one of the things that we did learn is that McGill is not unique. The way that the university deals with us, the problems that we have, everybody all over the country has similar problems with their employer. So it's sort of reassuring, but just to say that we do have people that have the same experience as us, so we're able to rely on them to see how they resolved issues. So it is a very good place for networking. It's a nice system in which you could meet the people that are at University of British Columbia and that they also have similar problems and how they dealt with them. So it was very enlightening for us. On the last note, there was a lot of discussion regarding the upcoming federal elections. Now, as you all know, the Harper government are not fans of unions. They have been very, very tough on them over the last couple of years, and it's only going to get worse. So the PSAC has put together a fund that will address the upcoming elections and will start to promote, and they will do that through the locals and through the regional, promote options. We're not going to tell you who to vote for, but we're going to tell you who you shouldn't vote for. So that's going to be coming out during the summer and working all the way up to the election later in the fall. And that is all I have for the executive report. Do I have a question?
Just a clarification in your executive report. You say that a proposal based on member feedback and voted on today will be presented to the university very soon. We're not actually voting on.
No, sorry, that was a typo. It was it was supposed to be presented on today.
Oh, presented today, not voted on.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Tim.
So there's a national campaign about the federal elections. What form will that take, concretely speaking, here at McGill with MUNACA and other people who are interested?
Right now, I can't tell you because they have not provided us with any details as to how they're going to disseminate the money, because they put about $5 million aside for this campaign. And I'm actually meeting with the regional office tomorrow, and I'm hoping to get a better idea of what the plan is regionally, because we do not want to create a separate plan here at McGill that is contrary to what other units are doing. We need to have a united front on this, and the PSAC wants to have this united front completely across the country.
Okay. Just to add that who not to vote for is cool, but I mean, I'm hopeful that the issues themselves will be explored and explained to people. And on top of that, like going forward, whoever wins, we need to make sure they're accountable for that victory. That is to say, if a liberal government or any other kind of government gets in, we need to hold them accountable for their policies towards organized labor in Canada and Quebec specifically.
Absolutely. Are there any other questions for the executive report? Great. Moving on, finance. And I will have David Kallant come up. David?
You've all been given copies of the financial statements. As usual, I'm not going to go through them in great deal with you. I will say I don't think any substantial changes compared to previous years. We are still in a good financial position. I'll just read them. I think it's easier than that because it doesn't show a full page up there. If you do have any questions, either now or, you know, if you can take yourselves more time to read them, you can always send me an email. Are there any questions on the financial statements? Joan.
Yes, first of all, last year I'd asked the question about the trust, and I'm very pleased to see that the executives moved ahead with that and the amendment passed. There's good work done on that. Just a couple of questions about the budget. The first thing is the legal fees.
Sorry?
The legal fees, the amount of legal fees.
Oh, we're not on the budget yet. I'm just looking at the auditor's statement for now.
Okay, I'll wait.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's go to the budget. Okay, Joan, you want to ask your question?
That just proves that I can wait. The legal fees seems like a huge item in the budget. Could that be detailed somewhat?
Well, the general legal fees here is primarily the retainer we pay, so that covers a lot of different things. Everything from our lawyer being here today to questions we submit and need answers for, like on pay equity, to working on grievances and that sort of thing.
The firm has dealt with all the pay equity issues, have they?
Sorry?
The legal firm has dealt with all the pay equity issues?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So it's really the retainer accounts for the vast majority of that. And so we can use it for whatever legal purposes we need.
How much is the retainer?
The retainer is, I'll go back to the financial statements. It's something like $4,300 a month, I believe it is, in that range.
So just the retainer takes up like 60, 70% of it?
Yeah.
Just the retainer,
yeah.
Okay. And then the member legal advice. I know MUNACA members can meet with a legal advisor.
That's right.
For free.
Yeah.
And that explains the $2,724.
Yeah.
And how much does that cost an hour?
I think she's up to $150 an hour now.
And which that is, includes legal advice on anything.
That's anything. For anything not labor related.
Not labor. And it's 1 hour that we
yes.
use? 1 hour.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, then moving on. And then the amount put for stewards, 15,000, and half of it is not used. Half of it remains unused. I always wonder why stewards aren't liberated more. For example, to go to the grievance council meetings, to meet with members. It doesn't seem like a lot of liberation.
We pay the liberation as is needed. We don't define the amount and then decide how they're going to be liberated.
And
but
to
why are you budgeting for 15,000 for the next year?
Okay. Because we're in negotiations. So people will be liberated much more than in normal years.
Okay, that's for people that are on the negotiation committee.
Yeah, primarily.
Saying that.
Yeah.
And then the third question is the amounts for the communication committee and the social justice committee.
Yeah.
I've always thought that they're sort of underfunded for the activities that they should be promoting within the union. Social justice, I think, has done a really, really good job of lectures, activities. They used to have a movie night that I loved. I wonder why they're not given more money and encouraged to do more projects.
Well,
for example, the communication committee, I wonder how they manage with 2,700. It doesn't seem like a lot to communicate.
I asked for budgets from them. Specifically for the communications committee, that's what they submitted to me. Now, I will say that the social justice committee did submit a higher budget. Some of those items in there we felt were... a redundancy. It's a repetition of efforts. For example, there was something for the federal elections, which PSAC is already dealing with, and we want to work under their auspices to make sure we're doing the same sort of thing. And then there were a couple of other items to do with the casualization campaign and also the $15 campaign, which MUNAC is already working on.
Okay.
So we didn't see why we should duplicate those efforts. I did tell them that if there are other items coming up, there are contingencies, and if I do get more explanation for why certain amounts are needed, they can be made available.
Okay. And then the budget, this is like half our fees, is it not? The other half goes to PSAC, is that correct?
No, this budget is just what we have locally.
That's what I'm asking. How much goes to PSAC then?
Okay, of your dues, you mean?
Yes.
Of your dues, slightly under 1% goes to PSAC Central, and the rest stays locally. So, and your total dues are 1.6% approximately.
So the 0.6 goes to PSAC?
The 0.6 stays locally.
And the 1 goes to PSAC?
Yes.
Yeah.
So like... 300 and some thousand would go to PSAC. Am I doing some math there? Or?
No, no. The budget I'm giving you here
yes.
is just our local.
That's what I'm asking.
So yes.
Could you give me a sum that goes to PSAC?
It's 1%. I'm not sure it's clear for it. It's 1% that goes to PSAC.
Of your dues.
Of
so
your
you
want
to know what the total
so
dues?
It's not 1% of our dues that goes to PSAC.
Yes, it
yes.
is.
So 1% would be like, if any, who can do the math here? Doesn't seem like a lot of money going to PSAC.
Oh, it's a lot of money.
It is.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Give me a sum.
I would say it's about 500,000.
Yeah.
Okay, so 5, that's what I, 1.6,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah,
that's what I, so
1.6 is the total yeah. collected, and 0.6 stays in the local
yes,
for us
what,
to function, and the budget is yeah. based on that 0.6.
That's what I had understood
yeah.
as well.
Okay.
The 1%.
1% isn't
it's
represented.
It's not the 1% of the 1.6.
No. No, 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 no,
no, no, no, no, no, no.
It's 1% out of the 1.6, yes. So 0.6 stays here, and 1% goes to PSAC.
So the 1% represents $500,000, and the 0.6 represents
roughly.
The 2,000.
Of what you see here, 300
is what we say local.
Okay, so is there a way of itemizing the service we get for this 500,000? I know we still have a full-time PSAC rep on campus, but I think he deals with all the groups now. Jean-Michel
mm-hmm.
still deals... What is he giving MUNAC as such? Because I know the arbitration, just I don't think any of the things from PSAC that have gone to Ottawa have ever actually gone to arbitration, have they? So what else are we getting? They have?
the costs not associated over and beyond employees' salaries. They spent about $160,000 on our arbitrations last year. So, but that doesn't include all of the PSAC staff that actually work on our files. That's like paying arbitration fees, paying for external law fees, and so on. Of course, they pay for our training. When our reps participate in training, that training is all paid for, including liberations. They pay for us to go to congresses. If our members choose to be part of committees, of course, all the committees, the regional organization. We are also members of the FTQ. There are fees that have to go to the Canadian Labour Congress and the FTQ. These are the costs associated with being part of a union movement instead of just a local union.
So there's a lot of training then that you've gotten from PSAC?
Yeah, several, you know, every year there's a group of us that attend training in either English or French.
You mean stewards?
Yes. Or? Well, yes, shop stewards attend training.
Okay.
But just to be clear,
of course, there's
John,
also the strike fund, yeah.
The main amount is legal fees. They cover a great deal of legal fees. So whenever we need to access for any representation, either locally or nationally, they provide that and they pay for it completely.
And I just want to point out, other unions don't actually pay for those legal fees. That's not a standard practice in other big unions. It's usually left more to the locals to pay their own fees.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Tim?
Yes, relative to Social Justice Committee budget, So if there are these efforts with PSAC over the federal elections campaign and with a muse on $15 and a mirror on casualization, do those, specifically a muse and a mirror, do they have money that they're going to be using from their dues in order to do these campaigns?
I don't know what they have.
Okay, because no. We do.
I haven't seen their budget.
So if we work together, then the money that was in the budget originally is in part thought of as like, oh, we're not sure if they have that money. We put it in there so that we could use it to do work on campus when we all meet together in order to plan things.
This is the sort of explanation I need before we decide.
None of us knew that you were working on federal elections and muse in a mirror. So
yeah.
If we had known, we would have given you the responses that you wanted. And I hope that we can amend this budget if possible, because I don't, when there's a concrete incarnation from the PSAC about the federal campaign, Social Justice Committee members would be happy to work on those, on organizing, and I'm sure Amuse and Amir would as well.
Okay.
So,
provide me with more concrete details of what you want to do, and we can relook at it.
And we should get some concrete details as well.
As soon as we get them, you will.
Yep.
Great. I agree.
Can I just, Tim, there's a political action committee for the region of Montreal for the PSAC, as well as FTQ, and any member in this room or any member in general is welcome to attend those meetings. They're more than welcome to be part of those committees. Just want to let you know.
They are predominantly French.
Well, yeah.
Mark.
Yes, I would like to know the legal fees, you know, what we pay for legal fees, and Renaud Plante, the PSAC lawyer, what he does for us, and who pays for, what do we pay for, and what does Renaud does for us?
Okay, well, just in terms of the finances, Renaud works for the PSAC, so that comes out of their legal fees pocket, and that's paid for by the dues that are sent to PSAC Central. Our legal fees are to our legal firm, and Sabella is a member of that firm. So it's things other than what PSAC will cover.
Like today.
Now for the specifics of what Renaud does, maybe I'll...
I can explain a little bit the distinctions. Okay. Do you prefer in French? No? English? I can explain a little bit what our firm handles. Because I think what the question was, what exactly are the types of files that PSAC will take, and why are there types of files that the local pays for? That's what I understand. So there is a certain division. The way that what I understand, and I don't work for the PSAC, but I do files for them, is that there are certain cases that will be like, for example, if a casual is not a real casual, and we want to include them in the MUNACA bargaining unit so that they keep the job but become MUNACA, that's a procedure that we call a 39. If somebody's fired or reprimanded for union activity, that's a 15, and then we have grievances, and then so we have multiple procedures like that. So every time we want to claim someone as being part of the unit, those procedures take a lot of time, a lot of money, very long. PSAC does those. They have their own attorneys that take care of all of those procedures. Grievances, as far as grievances are concerned, PSAC will evaluate a grievance that's filed by a MUNACA. If they feel that the grievance should move forward, they will take it on. If they feel for any reason the grievance does not seem to be one that could be winnable or maybe not move forward for all sorts of reasons, they won't necessarily take it on, but the local has the choice to take it on. So there are grievances that there aren't many, to be honest with you. I don't think I'm doing any grievances.
There are none.
There are none.
They haven't refused any.
There is a choice that there's none that they've refused. So I am doing, when you see the item, 60,000 might seem like a lot, but for an over 1,000 member unit, unfortunately, as a lawyer, I have to tell you, it's not that much. So the vast majority of the legal work is being assumed by PSAC. Sometimes they will hire my firm. Sometimes they will give it to somebody internal. Your union does do quite a few cases of reprisals for union activity, cases that go in front of a special labor relations board that the union will assume if PSAC says we won't assume it. Now, again, I think it was expressed, but in a lot of unions that are in federations, the local will have to assume everything. The deal that you guys have is that you actually assume a very, you know, a smaller percentage of it, and that's all I can say.
The executive wanted the members to have the best of all worlds. We want to have the best service. When we assign somebody like Sabelle, who is a brilliant litigator, which I can say because I've heard her in court many, many times, and her colleagues are as well, then you know you're in good hands. But also our local executive and our board members decide what's going on with that file. We like to have the control over what's happening in those files. It's pretty that simple. I mean, we don't want to be... It's one of the most effective ways we have of ensuring the members' rights are expected and management gets the point. So, you know, it's really about covering it from all angles. We have the support of the PSAC, and they put a lot of resources in, but then if we need to act more quickly or we need to have some more independence, then we have our own retainer and we can do that. Kevin can pick up the phone, ask for advice from Sabelle. It's extremely useful for the running of our local.
Okay, are there any other questions about the budget? Oh. Nancy.
I'll be quick.
Okay.
It's in regards to the PSAC and they're working for us. And I know I'm speaking to people that would like to see this happen as well, like the executive, but it was mentioned, Sabelle mentioned that PSAC deals with the Article 39s and the 15s. I'll just be talking, I'd just like to address the 39s. There's a backlog. And I personally have worked on 39s in the library. That means we have managers M's doing our work, and I filed them. It's passed through the grievance committee, and last December, and they're not even on. Been accepted by PSAC.
Nancy, sorry. Yeah. What does this have to do with the budget?
It has to do with. It was explained that PSAC did certain things, and our local did other stuff. But when PSAC comes up short and doesn't support us in a way, maybe I'm just bringing it to the attention of the people here that maybe, I guess maybe the next recourse is to go to MUNACA and have MUNACA hire the firm on this? Or in other words, we're not getting what is promised us through PSAC with the 39s.
Okay,
that's what I'm saying.
We've had this discussion at the BOR, the Board of Representatives. We've had this discussion with the grievance committee. The Article 39s do not belong to the local. They belong to the PSAC. Right. It is up to them to decide that, yes, I'm going to go and say this person belongs in here. We have no control. I could throw all the money in the world at it. I have no legal binding method to say that I could win a 39. And I'm sure Sabelle could reiterate that. It is not our
I just want to specify something about delays. I'm not on the 39s. I'm not the lawyer that PSAC put on the 39, so I don't, and they're not here. I have no interest in it, but I plead a lot in front of the Commission des Relations du Travail in 39s or across Quebec. You have dozens of 39s on this campus. Each of those is a case. Each case needs a judge, needs lawyers available on each side. I don't know about the particular cases. I'm not telling you that. I'm just saying when you consider how long it takes, and it's not to defend PSAC, I'm not on these cases at all, but it takes extremely long if we were to take those case per case. My understanding is that there are efforts to take them in bulk, and I think the union is doing on this, honestly, I started the 39s 5 years ago, and I've been taking off them since, which is not a problem. I have a million other cases, but I know for a fact that there's a real, volonté, if you will, on the part of the union, PSAC and MUNACA, to move forward. But the other lawyers have to be available, the court has to be available, and the CRT put a special procedure for these particular cases because there were so many. So the delays are not, I can tell you, have absolutely nothing to do with we're not moving these forward. There's dozens and dozens before the ones that you're talking about, and they all have to be heard by separate judges. And I think that creates incredible amount of frustration, which I understand, but I just wanted you guys to know the context.
And was it brought up when you went to Quebec City, the issue of the 39s with PSAC, like on the floor getting some more help, you know, from grievances, you know, the officer? Did you bring a motion to the floor for some more support, grievance support, while you were at Quebec City?
When we were in Quebec City, we did bring up legal representation. Okay. A lot of people brought up legal representation and how that should be changed. Now, if it's going to have any impact, I can't say. The 39s in particular, no. They were not a subject matter. Okay. They were included in the general discussion regarding legal representation and how to make that more efficient. But the 39s on their own were not discussed because, remember, we're in a meeting with 800 representatives and nobody cares about our locals' 39s. Everybody's got their other issues. And I can tell you the number that we have is unusual for the PSAC. We have a large number of 39s in comparison to the other groups.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions about the budget?
About the budget, no, but Mike has to leave. I want to thank you guys very much for all your work.
Thank you for coming.
So then we're going right on to the next item. That's the naming of the auditor. Once again, we have named Finestone Chan to do the audit for next year. And that's it for finances. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Moving on to the last item, question period. Are there any questions? Go ahead. He just did it. Oh, sorry.
Just more some clarification, really, because I know we were dealing with the increase, minor increase, I guess we could say, in the MUNACA PSAC dues recently in the correspondence on how you guys were told, or rather not told, that there was an increase. First, I was just curious to know about, has that been resolved, where they will contact you like they're supposed to do when it comes to an increase like that? I mean,
they better. I can tell you that, again, we had like 800 representatives at this meeting, and all of the units are divided into either components or directly chartered locals, which is what we are. Mm-hmm. So there was a specific meeting just for the directly chartered locals, and I raised that question to the vice president, national vice president, who's responsible for this. And he admitted that, yes, they messed it up. We should have been told. He personally assured us that he would do that in the future and would make sure that the communication system is in place. I hope that's true, but we all made it clear in that room that we will not put up with that happening again. So it was definitely raised.
Okay. And just the second part to the slight increase. Now, what was this? How much was the slight increase that we were given for? Because I want to know you guys are calling it, because we know PSAC did not increase their, will not be increasing their dues over the next 3-year mandate. I guess it is that they decided at the, in Quebec City. Is that right?
Oh, that's coming next year. There will be an increase next year, and we will be breaking that down in the fall to describe how that came about. We're waiting to get the final documentation from the PSAC, but during the Congress, there were many things that were raised, and all of these, we'll say, projects require money,
right.
And so things were presented and passed that will increase the dues.
Okay, so I guess the information that was on the PSAC website was out of date, because I could have sworn I read something that said that there was going to be no increase over the next 3 years.
Because that's what they propose with their budget.
Right.
But then there are lists and lists of other proposals for budgetary items, and some of those did pass. So what they did on the website is they presented what they, the financial PSCC National, presented their budget based on what they felt that needed to be done. However, during the course of the Congress, there were things that were passed that will result in increases in the budget, or sorry, in the dues.
So the next mandate, I guess, say for PSAC is supposed to start in 2016. Is it January 2016? Okay. So to the slight increase that we received for the MNACA PSAC portion, guys, please correct me if I'm not.
No, you're correct. It's the MNACA portion.
Yeah. First, I can't speak for myself, but were we ever told that there were going to be technically two separate dues? I know that's not really the right way of explaining it, but when we joined PSAC, because what I'm really asking is that, is there a possibility that every 3 years for MNACA and 3 years for PSAC that we technically could be getting dinged twice over
yes.
that period? Okay.
The simple answer is yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now,
because when we created our portion for the local, mm-hmm. we based it on the minimum. That not everybody does that, but we felt that we didn't really need to have more mm-hmm. because we had our reserves, but we went in with the minimum. And of course, the minimum will always go up.
Right.
So over the course of time, and that was 3 years ago was the last time, they decided that they recalculated it, and in conformity with the constitution of the PSAC, they had to raise it slightly. And again, okay. I think it's something like 12 cents,
yeah,
10
yeah,
cents.
12
I mean, it's not a huge amount, but I agree that they needed to let us know that before they actually did it.
Is there any thought of making it so that the increases come across the board in 1 3-year mandate rather than having it, say, one in halfway through 2015 and the other one beginning in 2016? Would it make any more sense of that, or is it just a matter of...
The only way to do that is for us to increase our portion mm-hmm. beyond the minimum. And between you and I don't see any point in doing that
right.
when we don't have any need for it.
Right.
So unfortunately, we are bound by the PSAC constitution.
Right.
And in that constitution, it outlines the process. Now, it may be that in 3 years, when they reassess what is the average for the components, it may not have changed, or it may have gone down. That's okay. a possibility. It may
right.
go up, you're absolutely right, but right. it may not move at all.
Okay. All right, cool. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else have any questions? Great. Well, thank you very much for coming. And I wish you all a happy and safe summer. And we will see you in the fall, where we will have special assemblies to deal with both the... Yes, I'm not finished. where we will have the merger finalized, and we will also have the trust fund finalized. So I move to adjourn the meeting at this point.
I move to adjourn. And then he seconds it.
Then speak into the microphone.
I move to adjourn this meeting. Do we have a seconder?
I second.
Thank you. And please don't forget, there is the barbecue next week, and I hope to see you all there. Thank you.